From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden. This episode...
The gay rights war is nearing an end.
Is the fight for gay rights over? In major U.S. cities, the LGBT movement has made significant strides toward equality, but that doesn't necessarily mean the war's been won. Our cover story checks in on the gay rights movement and how location, age, and race plays into each individual's level of acceptance in the community. Then, space, the final frontier.
It's almost a really different dimension, and it's like a dream.
But without the shuttle program, how do astronauts fit into the new NASA of Mars rovers and rocket launches? We hear from two space cowboys, one veteran space walker, and the other a persistent newcomer, on the future of the space program. Next, author Teddy Wayne tells us about his new novel, The Love Song of Johnny Valentine, and the struggles that accompany the sudden fame of a YouTube sensation.
Entrepreneurial narcissism is, I think, one of the defining features of our age.
Then we hear from a real-life YouTube sensation, singer Natalie Dawn, who gained internet fame as half of the pop duo Pomplamoose. She has a new solo album out called How I Knew Her.
I wish you had written me a letter.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. It's a watershed time in the gay rights movement. 9 states and D.C. now legally recognize gay marriage. And in the spring, the Supreme Court takes on the Defense of Marriage Act. More Americans now accept gay marriage than oppose it, according to the Pew Research Center. And last month, President Obama mentioned gay rights next to civil rights in his inauguration address.
The most evident of truths that all of us are created equal is the star that guides us still. Just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall.
After the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the Pentagon is moving toward extending certain benefits to same-sex couples. It's been a long and hard-fought struggle. Our cover story today is the gay rights war winding down. Hank Plant is a veteran journalist of 35 years and one of the first gay reporters on TV. And I asked him, from his sense of history, how far he thinks the movement has come.
I certainly think that the gay rights war is nearing an end. You know, I got a provocative email from a friend who's a very prominent gay journalist, and it had two words: it's over. I don't know, Jackie, it's like, I'm sure you've covered your share of campaigns. Mm-hmm. At some point, you look around at the other reporters and you all kind of go, you know, this really feels over.
What about for younger people? I mean, do you think that they feel the same way that you do about the movement and how it's evolved?
No, they feel much more positive than I do, because that's the reason that it's over. This whole thing is generational. Young people, they don't care. They have gay friends. Even young evangelicals. There was a very interesting poll that was done in 2011 by the Public Religion Research Institute, and it showed nearly half of young evangelicals support gay marriage, compared to only 12% of evangelicals who are over 65.
So you've covered gay rights for decades. What are some of the standouts in terms of the arc of the movement?
Well, of course, beginning with Stonewall in 1969. But you know what I think really turned things around, and it sounds strange to say this, is the AIDS tragedy actually benefited gay rights. First of all, it brought a lot of gay people out of the closet. But also, I think that straight people gained new respect for members of the gay and lesbian community as they saw gay people stepping up and helping their friends.
Right.
Obviously, it continues to be a horrible tragedy, but if anything positive comes out of it, it'll be that.
I'd like to ask you something personal. 35 years of being an out gay reporter, how does it look today from the way it did when you were a younger man?
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful. For me, at my age, to see the President of the United States use his inaugural address to compare gay rights to the civil rights movement, I never thought I'd see this day. And, you know, a lot of people worked hard for this over the years. I just feel very grateful about it all. And I don't want to minimize that there are battles to be fought. One is Proposition 8, which is the gay marriage case in California. That comes before the U.S. Supreme Court. And then DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. And then the Employment Non-Discrimination Act also has to be dealt with in Congress. You know, you can still be fired in 29 states just for being gay.
You are. I hope I'm not outing you here, 66.
I'm openly 66.
And so in your lifetime, and there are plenty of good years left, gays will see full and equal rights under the law in the United States.
Absolutely, no question about it. Any poll that you look at shows that the vast majority now in America supports full equal rights, including marriage equality for lesbian and gay people.
One of those 29 states where you can be fired for being gay is Kentucky. Chris Hartman directs the Fairness Campaign in Louisville, a gay rights advocacy organization.
It is still legal currently in most of our state to fire someone from a job, deny them a place to live, or kick someone off a bus or out of a restaurant if someone thinks that they're lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender.
Aren't gay people covered by the same laws that would protect against discrimination based on race or religious affiliation?
Unfortunately not. Both the federal and our state Civil Rights Act do have discrimination protections based on someone's race, religion, color, national origin, familial status, disability. In Kentucky, even your smoking status is protected. But we do not have those same types of protections based on actual or perceived sexual orientation or gender identities.
Are there any specific cases of bias in Kentucky that you've had to deal with?
Unfortunately, yes. As recent as last year, in the city of Richmond, Kentucky, we had a young lesbian couple taking maternity photos in a park. They were asked by their photographer to share a brief kiss. When they did, a park attendant approached them, said, "We don't accept your kind here," and forced them to leave the premises.
How about in housing?
In Elizabethtown, a gentleman, he and his partner, who had been looking for their perfect apartment, they found it after months of searching. They went to sign the lease, and they were told in no uncertain terms that they would not rent a one-bedroom apartment to two people of the same gender.
Do you think that this type of discrimination is more pervasive in rural areas?
It certainly is a problem in places that don't have these types of discrimination protections, what we call fairness laws. This type of discrimination occurs many places, but in places that don't have these types of protections, people who are prone to prejudice or who would commit discriminatory acts are emboldened to do so when leaders in their community will not step up and extend these types of anti-discrimination fairness protections. It's true in most of Kentucky and in all southern states that do not have these anti-discrimination fairness ordinances.
So do you think that there's quite a ways to go before activists can declare that the war for gay civil rights has been won?
Absolutely. In a lot of places in the country, folks feel that we're so close, that marriage is sort of the final frontier. And, of course, Barack Obama has created some watershed civil rights moments. But in a state like Kentucky, where you can still be fired from your job, it feels like the battle has just begun.
That's Chris Hartman, the director of the Fairness Campaign in Louisville, Kentucky. In Wyoming, Kathy Connolly is the first openly gay representative there. She's working to get gay rights legislation passed, a tough feat in a conservative state where Connolly is one of just 8 Democrats of a 60-member House. She represents Laramie. Laramie is the city that became infamous for the brutal 1998 murder of Matthew Shepard, who was targeted for being gay.
GLBTQ individuals don't want to wake up in the morning and say to themselves, "Oh my goodness, I'm gay and I live in Wyoming." In fact, what we want to and need to do is just go to work, have our lives, live with our families, be active in our communities, and just have sexuality like everyone else's sexuality, just be part of who we are.
And while Connolly says that Wyoming's come a long way, the job's not done.
We need relationship recognition. We need anti-discrimination laws. We need to be able to raise our families without needing to worry about legal documentation. So the struggle is not over with, especially not here in Wyoming.
Part of the struggle has also been reflected in popular culture. In shows like Will and Grace, and nearly 20 years ago in the television show My So-Called Life. 1994's My So-Called Life developed a cult following, in part because one of its principal characters, the Puerto Rican teenager, who comes out to his family and is then kicked out.
It's sort of like I don't have a place to live.
That's actor Wilson Cruz playing Ricky Vasquez. He got the role when he was just 19, and it mimicked his own life. He had just come out to his family, and his father kicked him out. He was homeless.
I lived in that car for a few months and on friends' couches until we started shooting the series, My So-Called Life.
Your parents just couldn't adjust quickly in those days.
My father couldn't adjust very quickly. My mother was fine. And I remember when I auditioned for Mary Goldberg and said to her, you know, regardless of whether or not I'm cast, I want to thank you. I'm grateful that they're even attempting to put this on television because I knew how powerful it would be to me to see it and how powerful it would have been for me as a teenager to have seen Ricky Vasquez on television.
To see an openly gay character on television, to see a role model that you could identify with.
Right. I mean, you know, for the most part, even sadly still, most of the LGBT characters that we see are white men.
And
I was not a white male. And Ricky really was saddling a few different communities. He was half black and half Puerto Rican.
Did people write to you? Did people say the fact that you played this gay Hispanic teenager on TV, that it was something that helped validate their own lives?
Yes. People still write to me today about Ricky Vasquez.
Wow. And
to be sitting at a bar and having a young person come up to me in tears, letting me know how they were affected and how they were for the first time able to see themselves mirrored and their experience is still very, very moving to me. I can tear up right
just
now
thinking
just thinking about it.
No backlash then, I gather. Nothing.
No, I
from the Hispanic community, for example.
We were waiting for it, let's be honest, and there was none. And I think that really had to do a lot with the way that Ricky Vasquez was written. He was the moral compass of that show. He was the perfect person to convey the message at the time.
When you watch TV today, do you see a kind of diversity, at least when it comes to human sexuality, that you think, wow, if I hadn't been that character all those years ago, maybe I wouldn't be looking at this?
I do. Do I wish I saw more? Yes. But when I look at, for instance, Glee, and I look at an actor and a character like Unique, who's a transgendered young girl, I think that actor won't know the effect of that portrayal until, like I did, until he's much older and hears from fans. I look at Chris Colfer and the way that he's handled himself and how he's portrayed that character. I feel like I may be, you know, the granddaddy of them all, and I couldn't be prouder.
That's actor Wilson Cruz, who played Ricky Vasquez, one of the first gay Hispanic roles on television. Today, the struggle for gay minorities is still harder. The National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs finds that gay people of color make up nearly 90% of the hate murder victims. It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. Space exploration. It stirred our imaginations, piloted our hopes and dreams as a people, made us dizzy over its possibilities of a brave new world of Tomorrowland.
Space, the final frontier.
America's Mercury astronaut!
Say again, please.
Houston, we have a problem.
We have a baby.
But in the future, will the great NASA programs that put Neil Armstrong on the moon put the next and the next generation of astronauts anywhere off Earth? Would you settle for exploring an asteroid? Or will our airbrushed dreams of space evolve with a kind of public-private partnership that couldn't have been imagined when Houston scientists still used slide rulers? That's our cover story tonight, where we've been, where we're going, and the future of space exploration, an Earthling perspective. Brian Shiro is a distinctly terrestrial sort. First of all, he's a geophysicist. That's just his day job, though. He's still working on his childhood dreams.
When I was in middle school, I went to space camp down in Alabama, which was just phenomenal. And, you know, I knew then that I had to be an astronaut. In fact, I remember I was up in the front of the group of kids, and I asked, where's your zero-G room? Because I just thought it had to exist.
Brian Shiro, who's 34, now lives in Honolulu. A generation ago, he would have been in orbit by now and become a NASA astronaut. He's got all the skills, the math, the science, the multiple marathons run. For his dream, he's invested all his vacation and free time into training to be an astronaut. He did make it to zero gravity in a centrifuge here on Earth in a NASA-sponsored training exercise.
This helps prepare you for the, you know, the way the blood moves in your body during the launch and reentry. Another thing we do that's really interesting is we spin everybody around in this device. You might call it a torture device, and it's meant to find where your motion sickness tolerances are.
But now, NASA's just not doing manned missions. Last year was the final year of the space shuttle. Now, if a NASA astronaut wants to get to the International Space Station, he or she must hitch a ride there on a Russian rocket. And as NASA cuts back on the manned mission idea, the private sector is stepping up in various ways. Tarek Malik writes for the website space.com.
Elon Musk, the CEO of SpaceX and Tesla Motors, he put all of his own money into these private rockets and spaceships. And last year, in 2012, they flew not only once, but twice to the space station with this robotic cargo ship.
One thing space exploration is fostering is adventurism. Richard Branson is the owner of Virgin Airlines. He founded a private space company of his own called Virgin Galactic and hopes to open a spaceport in New Mexico for tourists later this year. He'll offer 6-minute weightless rides into space. And a slew of other private companies are building and testing spaceship prototypes to carry people and cargo, all in the hopes that space exploration will be profitable. John Grunsfeld is a retired astronaut and the Associate Administrator for Science at NASA. He says this is all just as it should be. It's a natural evolution, a seed company spinoff from NASA, if you will.
The reason they're successful is because we've had 50 years of investment in learning how to explore space. You know, the technology for the engines, the turbopumps, the launch systems, the electronics, the computers. You know, all of that is now flowing out into the private sector in these more innovative companies. And when they are successful, it will make our space program stronger and also provide an economic engine for the country.
For astronaut hopeful Brian Shiro, these private companies may be his best hope of getting off Earth. Twice, he's applied to be a NASA astronaut. Last week, he found out once again that he didn't make the cut. No worries, he says. He intends to become an astronaut with or without NASA. So you are ready. You are ready to go into space.
Yeah, at a moment's notice. If you need an astronaut, I'm here.
Check out his website. It's called Astronaut for Hire. Send this man into orbit. How about 7 continuous months of orbit? That's how many days and weeks Michael Lopez Alegria spent in space. He's a record-breaking former astronaut who spent more hours spacewalking than any other human being. And he says Shiro shouldn't get discouraged, and neither should you nor I if we want to go into space.
To become an astronaut in the government sense requires a certain sort of type of education, you know, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, that sort of fields. What I would add now is that if you like journalism, for instance, and not math, you can also become an astronaut. It might be a different way, but NPR should be sending people to space in the not-too-distant future.
I'm ready. So NASA's role, says John Grunsfeld, the NASA administrator, is to keep undertaking things like the Hubble telescope and Mars rovers and other big concept ideas.
What we do at NASA is inspiring, it's reaching, it's visionary, and it inspires people here on Earth to try hard things. I think it's really a sign of great American strength that we do invest the money we do in technology in these hard projects in NASA.
Just last summer, when the Mars rover touched down on Mars, the action in the NASA control room was live broadcast to a crowd of thousands in New York's Times Square.
Touchdown confirmed. We're safe on Mars.
But exploration comes at a price, a big one. Let's go back to Tarek Malik, the writer for Space.com, who explains the NASA budget.
Last year, they did take a hit. They had a relatively flat budget of $17.7 billion. That was still, you know, $59 million less than what they got in 2012. And they had to make cuts. They cut hundreds of millions of dollars from planetary science. And this is in a year where they had a spectacular success. They landed the biggest robot on Mars that could move around, the Curiosity rover.
17.7 billion sounds astronomical, but it isn't really, says John Grunsfeld of NASA.
Our country, you know, invests a tiny fraction of 1% in NASA, and this is what's so amazing to me is with that small investment, we do so much for the country.
So NASA is trying to reset its goals. President Obama has talked not of revisiting the moon, which President George W. Bush had done, and the money for that visit never materialized. Instead, President Obama has reconceived the next big space push.
NASA's goal, as set by the Obama administration, is to send astronauts out into deep space to visit a near-Earth asteroid by 2025. And if that goes swimmingly, then to take aim at Mars sometime in the mid-30s.
And Tarek Malik thinks visiting an asteroid is pretty gutsy.
And everyone can see the moon at night. When Obama took office, he scrapped that plan to trade it with this asteroid one, which they hope will capture the imagination of folks more because it's never been done before.
He points out that space exploration is still wildly popular with the public. Last year, NASA got more applicants for the next astronaut training class than ever before, and that class will be announced this spring. So space travel still has a cultural role to play as a change agent for the future, an embodiment of what-ifs. At the National Air and Space Museum here in Washington, visitor Bruce Prestige remembers a time when just sending people into space seemed impossible.
We first heard the beep from Sputnik when I was a kid, and nobody thought, no, nobody will ever be able to go up in space, no human being.
Sputnik, remember what we just told you, that last year's NASA astronaut applications were the largest such pool ever. And the dreams of going into space seem like a shared optimism for us Earthlings. Michael Lopez Alegria says he still wants to go back.
It's amazing now when I look back, and I mean, I sound like an old retired guy, which I am now, but even after I flew the first time and the second time and a month later, you'd go back and try to sort of live the moment again, and you can't do it. It's just such a different, it's almost a really different dimension, and it's like a dream. So you can be there or you can be here, but you can't be in both places at the same time.
And even if we don't send an astronaut to Mars, we're still making amazing discoveries.
We have discoveries every single day. One of the recent things that we discovered with Hubble is an observation from something called the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. And this was an observation where Hubble stared in one part of the sky for a long time to bring out a time-lapse picture of the ancient universe. And we've observed now a galaxy, and actually there's more than just one galaxy, that existed when the universe was only about 500 million years old. And so we're seeing for the very first time baby pictures of the universe.
Baby pictures of the universe. Yesterday's news of the Mars rover drilling into rock. A Chinese New Year's greeting and song sent from astronauts in space. New discoveries every day. The science fiction writer Ray Bradbury, author of The Martian Chronicles and many other books, died last summer. He was born in 1920 and definitely came from a time when space exploration was only a dream. But it was something he deeply believed in. He once told Playboy magazine, "We need something larger than ourselves. That's a real religious activity. That's what space travel can be, relating ourselves to the universe." As we learned in the movie Alien, in space, no one can hear you scream. Of course, we can't hear anything because there is no atmosphere out there. But scientists can still use sound to understand the solar system a little better by turning the masses of data collected by NASA satellites into sound and music. Robert Alexander is a sonification specialist with the Solar Heliospheric Research Group at the University of Michigan. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, we're delighted to have you, and we're all wondering what a sonification specialist is.
So what I do is I take data and I translate it into sound. I myself work mostly with solar wind data and data from satellites and explore these sounds in a new way.
And how do you convert that data into sound without getting into a blizzard of technical details?
Sure. To sonify data is essentially to take any given data parameter. So it could be, let's say, the speed of the solar wind. Mm-hmm. And I can then map that and create a sound, a whooshing sound like whoosh, that represents the solar wind in some kind of way.
Okay. Let's hear an example of what you do, Robert. And this is the heartbeat of the sun. So that's pretty cool. Kind of reminds me of listening to a heat ventilation shaft, but of course, it's the sun. What are we actually hearing right now?
So that's actually 40 years worth of solar data. It's several hundred thousands of lines worth of data. And what we're listening to, I've filtered out a lot of the high frequency content. So we're listening to this low hum, and that's created by the rotation of the sun, actually. When you have something that's rotating like the sun every 27 days, over the course of 40 years, we end up with this underlying hum, essentially.
Is there something about the sun that lends itself to sonification as opposed to any other planetary body or the moon?
The sun, it's a window into getting to know many other stars much more deeply. And we have so many satellites up. They're all streaming down masses of information. And you know, we have so much of this solar data, and we're trying to find ways to quickly and effectively navigate it all. And sonification offers us a way to, you know, possibly begin to do that.
Now, it is, after all, a sound experiment, and you're getting scientific inquiry from it. But I understand you've also taken it a step further just for yourself, and you've actually composed some music from these sounds. Let's just listen for a moment. Well, Robert Alexander, what you've done is incredibly beautiful. I hope you can take this music maybe to, you know, a hall and people can hear it somewhere.
Sonification does really lend itself to education and public outreach because I think a lot of people, they see a graph and they just kind of turn off. And I think sonification has the potential to really engage the curiosity of the listener and to relate to it on a human level and more of a visceral level.
Well, thanks for a fascinating conversation.
Thank you so much.
Robert Alexander is a sonification specialist with the Solar Heliospheric Research Group at the University of Michigan. He turns solar data into sounds and music. In 1972, in Philadelphia, an immigrant couple welcomed the birth of their fifth child, a boy they named Erdny. But a few years later, the Dalai Lama renamed him Tello Tulko Rinpoche and identified him as one in a long line of reincarnations of an ancient Buddhist saint.
The elder monks, they saw something unusual in me.
Rinpoche is the name given to all reincarnated Buddhist high lamas. As a young boy, Tello Rinpoche was taken to monastery in the mountains of southern India to learn the teachings of Buddha on his journey to monkhood. He was one of the first of his kind, a Westerner learning thousand-year-old traditions a world away from his family. In part because of the Dalai Lama's exile from Tibet in 1959, more and more Rinpoches are born in or exposed to Western culture. And while the West seems to embrace Tibetan Buddhism, a rising number of young lamas are renouncing their monkhood. It's a story that we first heard about in this month's issue of The Believer magazine.
Once you have broken your vows, then there's no going back.
When he was just 19 years old, the Dalai Lama sent Tello Rinpoche to Kamakhya, a Buddhist region of Russia on the Caspian Sea, where Soviet communists had destroyed temples and nearly the faith.
The people around you grew up in an atheist society. They believed that religion was poison.
He was charged with leading the people there back to Buddhism, a responsibility he called a tremendous pressure.
I think my emotions really took over and I became frustrated and I just got up and left.
Thelo Rinpoche can never go back to monkhood now. He's broken his vows, he has a wife and child. But after he left his post, he did meet with the Dalai Lama, who encouraged him to continue his work in Kalmykia nonetheless. Now, he lives half of his life in Erie, Colorado, together with his wife and son, and the other half in Kalmykia, where he has worked for 2 decades to re-establish Buddhism. It's been a success. He's worked to rebuild 27 temples, he oversees 7 lamas, and he himself is revered. 20 years ago, journalist Tim McGurk stumbled on a similar story in Spain. There, another young Western boy was identified by the Dalai Lama, also as a High Lama reincarnation, or Rinpoche. So Tim McGurk went to Granada to see the young Spanish Lama.
When I got up there, he was having a temper tantrum like any other 4-year-old. And it was because he was standing in a snowy vegetable garden. This nun who was with him was exasperated because the boy knew the cold and the ice were killing the plants. And so he was running around trying to sweep the snow off the vegetable plants so that they wouldn't die. And his hands were turning blue. And the nun was saying, please, you've got to put on your mittens. You know, your hands are freezing. I thought, well, this is kind of odd behavior for a 4-year-old child.
And what happened to this reincarnated Rinpoche?
He was packed off to a monastery in India, and the boy was absolutely miserable. You know, he was shoved back into the medieval setting of a monastery. And so after a while, he said, enough of this. I'm going to go study film and go to university and have a girlfriend and have a normal life. Many of his followers were Westerners. They were heartbroken that the Lama Yeshid that they'd known and loved and followed in his previous lifetime had kind of turned into this, you know, rather rebellious teenager.
What did begin to change? These Rinpoche started leaving their tradition. Why?
Because they were forced out of the monasteries, suddenly they were much more vulnerable to the temptations, to the desires, to the delights of the 21st century. It's one thing if you're shut away in a monastery, but it's another thing when you're, you know, wandering the streets of Delhi and you're hearing Bollywood music and you're seeing pretty girls, and, you know, suddenly all the years of meditation and training and, well, all that just kind of fell away at the sight of a beautiful woman in many cases.
So is this drifting away by a number of the reincarnated? Is that a disaster for the system?
I think that for a religion to renew itself, that it has to be kind of more in contact with the changing times. And many of these Rinpoches that I interviewed who've left the monastery, who've left the roads, you know, who now have more conventional lives, they still talk about the need to communicate the Buddhist teachings, but I think in more unconventional ways.
Tim McGurk's article, Reincarnation in Exile, is about the changing face of reincarnation in the Buddhist faith. It appeared in this month's edition of the Believer magazine. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jackie.
On this show, we've been asking filmmakers about the movies they never get tired of watching, the ones that they could watch again and again, including this one from the co-writer of Moonrise Kingdom.
My name is Roman Coppola. I'm a writer and director, and the movie I've seen a million times is Stardust Memories by Woody Allen, starring Woody Allen and Charlotte Rampling.
Well, Sandy, this is 2 lousy days. You drive up there, they honor you, they show you films, they ask you a couple of stupid questions, and you go home.
I don't want to be on it. It's a hype.
Well, the film is about a filmmaker who is invited to attend a retrospective of his work, and it becomes an occasion for him to do a little self-analysis and review of where he stands, and he has different recollections and memories from the past bubble up. And so the film has a very wonderful freedom to travel here and there through his memories and through his fantasies. And it's a film that is endlessly imaginative and, you know, has wonderful surprises around every corner.
Do you find it very hard to direct yourself?
Hard? No. I just have to resist the temptation to give myself too many extreme close-ups.
The film is filled with references and inside jokes that pertain to his body of work and other films that he admires. And it's all played for laughs, but the humor is rather tight to the vest. So things that I find to be very hilarious are hilarious in a very subtle way.
Yeah, well, we found a .32 caliber pistol.
Yeah, that's mine too. I carry a pistol. I have a thing about Nazis. It's a little paranoid weakness I have.
There's so many wonderful scenes in the movie, and the one that comes back to me, I guess, is there's a scene where the Woody Allen character speaks about his relationship with the Charlotte Rampling character.
You know, some time ago I had a love affair that ended sort of unhappily.
He recalls a memory of a Sunday morning, and there's an image of him looking at her, and she's reading the paper, she's laying on the floor and flipping through the Sunday paper.
It was one of those great spring days, a Sunday, and, you know, you knew summer would be coming soon. And I remember that morning Dory and I had gone for a walk in the park. We came back to the apartment, we were just sort of sitting around, and I put on a record of Louis Armstrong, which was music that I grew up loving, and it was very, very pretty.
And he evokes this feeling, this memory of this incredible moment they shared, and in a way all the troubles and all the difficulty they had sort of melts away, and at least he had that.
And for one brief moment, everything just seemed to come together perfectly, and I felt happy, almost indestructible in a way. And it's funny, that simple little moment of contact moved me in a very, very profound way.
And to be able to portray that, you know, in a film is just magical.
Baby, you're an old, dreaming of a song melody, my memory.
That's writer-director Roman Coppola talking about the movie that he could watch a million times, Woody Allen's Stardust Memories. Coppola's new film, A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swam III, is in theaters now.
My Stardust Melody, the memory of lovely friends, mama.
A new novel called The Love Song of Johnny Valentine explores the stratosphere of megastardom amid that classic of American novel tropes, the road tour. Destination, Madison Square Garden, New York City. The novel's hero is just 11 years old when we meet him. He has the sugar-sweet pipes of a Justin Bieber, whom he closely resembles. He also has a controlling manager mom, a missing father, and a retinue of people who work for him. We cross America with his crew by bus on Johnny's Make It or Break It big tour. Like all boys, he has to find himself. Johnny Valentine is the creation of Teddy Wayne, who joins us now from our bureau in New York. Welcome to the program, Teddy Wayne.
Thank you for having me, Jackie.
You have stumbled on here to the most authentic voice for this young 11-year-old protagonist. I mean, child stars have been a feature of American culture since they started making, you know, movies and then recording songs. But how'd you come up with Johnny Valentine?
Well, I first must say, as per the findings of Simon Schuster's legal team, that any resemblance to real persons living or dead is purely coincidental. So there's no direct corollary in the real world to this.
I'm glad we're covered, because I've shelled off enough from my mistakes this week.
But the voice is really a combination of a preteen, innocent grammar, run-on sentences, emotional comprehension of a child, colliding with this savvy, marketing, cynical voice of a veteran branding executive. And it actually derived in part from a freelance job I had for about 2 years, writing a business media and marketing column for the New York Times, which I'd interview people in the industry each week who spoke very much like marketing lingo experts.
Ah, so that is all the verisimilitude. Why don't we have you read something for us where we meet Johnny, since we're talking about his voice?
Sure thing. This is from page 2. His mother has just told him to go to sleep. His mother, Jane, who's his manager, because they have a big day tomorrow.
And we should say it's just the two of them. This is an intense mother-son relationship because they're each the only family the other has.
Right. So they've just hung up the phone. He's in his hotel room alone. I put down the phone and stared at it. It was easy for her to say I should try to fall asleep when she wasn't the one who just performed for 2 hours in front of a capacity crowd of 17,157 fans and had to take a meeting with a label tomorrow back in L.A., who was probably going to voice their concerns that the new album hadn't meaningfully charted yet, which meant it never would, since sales momentum rarely reverses at this stage in the game unless there's a major publicity coup. And now that I'd convinced myself Zolpidem was the only way, I didn't have a chance without it.
It's a little scary seeing an 11-year-old who knows what all different kinds of sleeping drugs are.
He steals his mother's Zolpidem, or Ambien is the non-generic term, and he self-medicates in various ways. He also is prevented from going onto the internet ever unsupervised. So throughout the novel, he sneaks onto her computer to check his email or see what the internet is saying about him. And actually early on, he discovers that a man claiming to be his father, his long-lost father, who left the family when Johnny was 5 or 6, is now trying to reconnect with him.
What intrigued you about making your star a child and not, you know, just an older rock star?
Well, you know, entrepreneurial narcissism is, I think, one of the defining features of our age. And it's one thing if an adult celebrity is hawking his own product, which is often himself. So if Ashton Kutcher is branding himself on Twitter, that's fine. But when a child does it, it becomes that much more pernicious. And the cracks in the facade of how we function as a society are that much more evident, I think.
And this is Jackie Lydon, just branding myself here, speaking to Teddy Wayne about his new novel. Let's talk about the lyrics that you've written here. One of his hit songs is called Guys Versus Girls. And it's been his hit, and they're all cheesy, mm-hmm. a little cloying, but they're genius. Could you give us the lyrics to Guys Versus Girls?
The chorus is guys, and then his backup singers sing guys versus girls, girls. Why's it got to be that way? Guys versus girls, will you be my girl today? I'm a very mediocre guitarist and singer, but I wrote the full song to it, and there's 4 verses plus the chorus, and in fact recorded my own version.
Guys versus girls, why's it got to be that way? Guys versus girls, will you be my girl today?
One of the things I found so effective here, Teddy, is he is wrapped in cellophane within cellophane. He can't get on the internet. And his mom is ruthless. She is his mom manager that always sets up some risk. But he knows how it's all done.
His mother, or momager is the term these days, is a fiercely devoted and loving mother. She wants very much to have gotten them out of the circumstances they were in St. Louis. She was a supermarket bagger at Schnucks Supermarket in St. Louis. And I think everyone can relate to a mom who wants something badly for a child, but maybe that's not what the child himself wants. There are many scenes of her being tenderly loving with him, of caring about his safety and protecting him, but there are also scenes in which she overlooks what he truly needs, which is a mother who's simply his mother, not his manager, too.
Did you think about other child heroes of other American novels at all? Am I out on a limb there thinking about a picaresque like with Huck Finn or Tom Sawyer?
Some people have said they see references to Huck Finn. There is something Huck Finnish about it. Huck travels along the Mississippi on a raft with Jim. Johnny travels across America on a tour bus with his bodyguard Walter. I don't know about quality if I could compare myself to the greats, but I don't mind putting in this picaresque tradition of American coming-of-age narratives.
Well, I could speak to you all day, Teddy Wayne, but thank you very, very much for writing the love song of Johnny Valentine.
Thank you so much, Jackie.
And it's time now for music.
All the single ladies, 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 all the single ladies,
all the single ladies.
Put your hands up, my tears, pretty good years, can't be mad at me.
The video for this version of Beyoncé's Single Ladies has been viewed more than 9 million times. The band is Pomplamoose, a couple from Northern California known for lighthearted cover songs, and they do a bunch of them. Check them out on YouTube. Now, the woman singing is Natalie Dawn, and she's about to release a solo album on Tuesday called How I Knew Her. While she retains a lot of the whimsy and charm of Pomplamoose, the music here reveals a whole different side of Natalie Dawn that Pomplamoose fans might not have known was there.
So you put on your suits and you're all in cahoots, but who cares? Silent prayers won't keep you from going insane.
Natalie Dawn is taking on some pretty heady topics on the record, including many references to faith and her struggles with it, despite growing up with parents who served as missionaries.
My father was a pastor and later on a theology professor, and my mother was always in charge of the music at church, and my parents were very much into a lot of gospel music. My mom was just a huge fan of the great old hymns, and I have to say they're still deeply ingrained in my subconscious. It's very hard for me to write things that don't sound just a little bit like a hymn.
There are a lot of references to faith on How I Knew Her. Was that intentional?
It was intentional in that it's what I've been thinking a lot about. The album is about relationships, and particularly about relationships with the women in my life who've mattered the most to me. And all of those women have had deep faith as a big part of their identity. And I definitely have ended up struggling with a lot of what I believe and what I was brought up with through the investigation of these relationships with the women who are closest to me in my life.
Grandma says I'm going to hell 'cause I met a boy and we make rock music, and the trouble is I know she means well. If I'm a misbehaving, it's the devil's due when she says life is a test.
Your grandmother, I have to ask you about her. Here in the song Still a Believer, it sounds a little strict. Grandma says I'm going to hell because I met a boy and we make rock music, and the trouble is I know she means well. She was probably quite accustomed to you singing church music. Maybe this was too difficult a stretch.
I think a lot of people in my family have trouble with the fact that I have strayed from my beliefs, and in particular with the fact that I'm not married and I've been living with my boyfriend, you know, who I've been in a relationship with for the past 6.5 years. And I think it's quite difficult for them to deal with the fact that I still claim to have some sort of faith, but that it's not really in line with my very strict Christian heritage. And that's why I'm still
a believer. Since this is a solo album, did it feel, I'm not suggesting that each song is a chapter in your own autobiography, but did it feel more autobiographical than previous work? Did you feel more that you were writing for your own voice?
Definitely. I mean, Pomplamoose's songs lyrically are pretty light. They don't really delve into issues of, you know, death, family, things like that. We stay pretty light, and there's a place for that, an important place for that in music, and I'm really glad that we make those songs. But I'd been going through a darker period in my life and trying to process a lot of that, and I knew that Pomplamoose was not the right outlet for the lyrics that I had written. So definitely there's a lot more of my story and a lot more of stories of people in my life who've meant a lot to me.
Well, can I ask then what's behind the song, Why Did You Marry?
Why did you marry? Oh, why did you marry? You could have been an actress, you could have been a doctor, you could have been somebody people wish they knew.
Part of growing up in a religious family is seeing everyone get married when they're babies. It's always been very scary to me. Even as a young girl, I was never the type to fall in love with someone and think, oh, we're going to get married. I've always been very resistant to the whole idea, just because I've seen so many people in the church get married really, really young. And I wish that there were more strong voices in the church and in the world who told girls that they didn't have to get married.
Well, that is an option in this country, at least. As you're speaking, I'm thinking of places where, you know, that might not be, which is its own kind of poignance.
Right? Oh, of course. And honestly, growing up in a very strict religious family, it doesn't feel like an option to not get married. I mean, either you lie to your parents and tell them that you're, you know, not living with your boyfriend, or you tell them and you risk the consequences of being cut off or judged, or, you know, there are a lot of really bad things that still happen in America to girls who admit that they're not living a life of chastity.
But I think that I know, yes, I know why you're married. It's just like in the movies, the novels and plays, where no one ever says, thanks, Cary Grant, but I think I'll just get my own place.
So a record that's almost like a journal, it shows a lot of different facets to your character. Really a lot. It's funny and it's challenging, it's poignant, spiritual. Sometimes here and there it's snarky. You know, that does that sum it up, all the different aspects of you?
I think you did a beautiful job summing it up, yes.
We'll set it to music.
All right.
That's Natalie Dawn. She's one half of the band Pomplamoose, and her new solo CD is called How I Knew Her. And you can check out a few tracks on our website, nprmusic.org. A very great pleasure, Natalie. Thank you.
Thank you.
I remember quite well the first time I took you home. We were so young. I didn't think much of you. Sure, you were cute and full of tricks and a whole lot brighter than a guinea pig. But I didn't think much of you back then.
And for the week ending February 10th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Liz Baker, Amy Held, Lily Percy, Acacia Squires, and Chris Connolly, to whom we say goodbye and good luck this week as he leaves us for sunny Arizona. Our interns are Annie Russell and Rachel Rude. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor. Steve Lichtai, our senior producer. I'm Jackie Lydon. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from Weekends on All Things Considered. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for tuning in.